Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. My name is Ben Snakehoff, and with me today we've got
Dominic Rabier
and David O'Brien.
We've got three great stories for you today. The first of which is about gene patents. The second is a tiff between eBay's and Tiffany. And the third case that we're going to talk about is a new round of extortion-like demand letters that have been sent out, like the ones that we were seeing in the RIAA versus the People cases from a couple of years ago. Some of which are still pending. So I guess we'll dive into the first case, which is more biotechnically legal than it is just technically legal. There was a case that's been brewing since about May of last year. The ACLU and a few plaintiffs filed suit against a company called Myriad. And Myriad holds patents on two genes that are related to breast cancer. And what ACLU was saying is that these patents on these breast cancer genes are against... They aren't what's called patentable subject matter under the Patent Act, first of all, and second of all, that they violate the First Amendment because these genes essentially code information. And as a result of this company holding these patents, people couldn't get second opinions, and sometimes they wouldn't even be able to get a breast cancer screening done because the cost was prohibitively expensive, and because the cost was prohibitively expensive and because their insurance wouldn't cover it. And I'd like to note here that this is podcast 44, and this will be published on April 6th, 2010. We got to that a little late, but I think we're fine. So I guess the first thing that came to my mind when I was reading this opinion was that it was wrong under current precedent. David O'Brien, do you agree with me or do you disagree?
Well, I think that this area is a really controversial area. There's a lot of different opinions out there, and I'm more along the lines of believing that this is probably a little incorrect under the current precedent, but, you know, I think that there's arguments that go both ways, and it's kind of close to call.
Dominic, do you agree or disagree? I'm sorry? Say that again?
What was the current precedent?
The most recent case about patentability and subject matter is Diamond v. Chakrabarty. In that case, I believe it was a GE engineer. It developed a new form of microorganism, a bacterium, that would digest oil, like an oil spill. So you'd go up to an oil spill, you'd pour some of the bacteria over the side of the ship, and the bacteria would eat up and digest the oil so that you wouldn't have these oil slicks anymore. And that patent was the... U.S. Patent and Trademark Office initially refused to grant the patent because it was on a living organism, and the Patent and Trademark Office thought that you could not patent a living organism. And the Supreme Court disagreed, and their essential holding, and it's oft quoted, is that anything man-made under the sun is patentable. And it's cited in this opinion, but it's not really discussed in depth as to how you can go from anything man-made under the sun is patentable to... a synthesized piece of DNA is not patentable. So, with that in mind, Dominic, do you think that the judge correctly decided this or incorrectly decided this under current law?
Well, I mean, a gene sequence isn't a living thing, so I think that's a distinguishing point.
Okay, but there's also a case, there's a case by a judge called Learned Hand. It's called Park Davis, and in that case, the person who was going after the patent purified a form of adrenaline that was at the time very useful in treating people with, I believe it would be low blood pressure, and this was not something that had previously been purified. And that case has it came out in 1911, so for 99 years now, it's been held out to say that purified forms of existing things are patentable. And in this case, the judge did a fair amount of acrobatics to say, well, that wasn't really a subject matter case, that was a novelty case. It struck me, reading this opinion, that the vast majority of cases that the judge cited were from 1930 and before, before a lot of the modern precedent about what is patentable and even, a lot of the modern patent cases have come out. And I think that really hurts the judge's opinion. He can't rely heavily on, recent cases because recent cases, frankly, don't support his opinion. Thoughts on that, David?
Yeah, first of all, I mean, why this is such a problem is that the particular area in the patent deck that we're referring to, the section 101, which defines patentable subject matter to some extent, hasn't been updated since 1952, and there's no mention in there whatsoever of anything about genetic material. And when you have a situation like this, where you have a biopharmaceutical company like Myriad Genetics, who owns a series of patents, and some people sort of allege that there's a bit of patent stacking going on, since Myriad actually owns, I think, 7 patents that relate to these 2 genes, that they then become the sole owner of basically all the ways of sequencing those genes. And through that, then, you have a situation where if you want to get any diagnostic testing done that relates to these 2 genes, and by the way, these genes, I think, actually relate to predictability factors for breast cancer and ovarian cancer. So if you what they do is they sequence the genes and they compare your genes to what normal looking genes should look like in your body, and if they detect certain abnormalities in them, then they can determine if you have a high percentage, I think it's around 70 or 75%, of developing one of those 2 types of cancer in your lifetime. So if they own all of the patents and all of the rights that are associated then with those 2 genes, then they effectively have just become the sole licensor of them, and they can prohibit whoever they want from doing any kind of diagnostic testing related to those 2 genes. And so then you get these 2 arguments that sort of pan out here, and that's, well, okay, so we've got this Patent Act and the language in it. It goes back to 1952. Congress hasn't spoken about this issue in a long time. We have pretty old decisions in case law. The Chakrabarty case is a 1980 case. So that's something that's 30 years old now. And, you know, within it, what we really got out of Chakrabarty was that it's okay to patent certain forms of organic material as long as there is some sort of human intervention that goes on, some sort of ingenuity, human ingenuity that's put into it. In the case of Chakrabarty's invention, it was a bacterium which was genetically engineered, so it was entirely, well, not entirely, because it was actually based on a already living form of the bacterium, but it was engineered by humans, and so therefore it's not naturally occurring in the wild. But then if you take the argument that the ACLU used in this case, it was more about these genes naturally exist in the human body as it is now. What was really being claimed in the Myriad patents was more along the lines of the isolation and purification process, and then the it was actually a method and process claim, and then the subsequent diagnostic process that's associated with taking out the isolated genes, sequencing them, and then comparing the results of the sequencing to what would be considered healthy genes in the human body. So that's why it's so controversial, but it's, you know, I don't know, it's a hard case to call because there's a lot of bioethics involved, I think.
Yeah, I think it's a good point you have that this is a controversial case, and patenting of genes has become has been controversial ever since people started doing it, you know, at the start of the Human Genome Project, you know, in the early 90s. In fact, there was a decision, I want to say it was from the mid-90s, that challenged gene patents on usefulness, but not subject matter. So there are a bunch of different requirements that you have when you're getting a patent. One of them is that, you know, what you're going for has to be useful. And it was a divided panel, if I'm remembering this right, of the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. 2 of the judges said, you know, a patented gene is useful as a research tool. And 1 person said, you know, it's not a research tool. The argument, for patents was that it's like a microscope. You use the gene to do more research. And the argument on the other side was, well, you know, you can use a microscope to look at anything that's small. You can use a patented gene to look at, you know, whether or not something else you're looking at is identical to that gene. It's not a particularly useful invention if it's useful. And, you know, the flip side of that is, well, that's, you know, maybe a good argument, but does that really go to, you know, whether or not it's useful? Because you just said it has some usefulness, it's just not a lot, or should you look for some other way to overturn the patent? Now that we're done with that brief aside, Dominic, any other thoughts here as to, you know, separating the legal judgment from the moral or ethical judgment?
Separating the legal judgment from them, I mean, I'd say that again. It seems like they're going against Supreme Court precedent if you just look at just the raw law without any regard to ethics.
Well, on that point, I mean, the Supreme Court was very clear in Chakrabarty, and they ended that decision before I think any of the concurring opinions, or I think there might have even been a dissent in that case, and they stated that, look, we're not going to read into the patent statute as it exists today, and we're not going to imply or find any sort of implicit limitations in the language that's there. What the statute says in Section 101 is pretty simple, and if Congress wants to step in and they want to provide for other restrictions on what should be patentable, then they should do it through the legislative process. The court's not going to hedge in and limit that based on, because people are upset that, parties can go about patenting organic material or something that might have been living at one point. And the Congress hasn't stepped in and done anything. So it seems like it's it's not quite legislating from the bench here, but this is definitely a good test case for the ACLU on biopharmaceutical patents like this.
Yeah, another really interesting thing that I picked up on in the opinion was the judge spent a lot of time talking about this kind of, I don't know how to put it other than an informational and physical, unity that exists in DNA. So for those of you who aren't too familiar with DNA, and I'll try to keep this as brief as possible, DNA are, long strains of basically information bits in your body, and there are four different bases. We'll call them A, C, G, and T, and each one represents a different chemical structure. In groups of three, they're called codons, and those in turn correspond to something called an amino acid, which is a building block of proteins. So all of these DNA, what the DNA does is it basically encodes proteins in your body. The result of your DNA will dictate your skin color, your eye color, your hair color, your hair type, height to some degree. It could have influences on such things as obesity, your prevalence, susceptibility to diabetes, susceptibility to certain diseases. And the judge was saying, you can purify adrenaline and you get a different product than the adrenaline that's in your body. But even if you purify DNA, what all of this research is going to isn't the DNA molecule itself, it's the information encoded in the DNA. And the information encoded in the DNA is a product of nature. And I thought that was a very interesting argument, but again, I don't really see how that's supported in the case law that's out there. David, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, no, not necessarily, but what's so different about the isolated gene than as it occurs in the human body? And I think that was the main argument one of the main arguments that the ACL had in their motion briefs. And they're saying there isn't really that much difference. I mean, there's a claim over the method and the process of extracting and isolating that gene, but it's really not that different in either form, whether it's inside the body or outside of the body. It's just in two separate places. So you're sort of the microbiology heavyweight here. Maybe you could explain if there are any differences that are relevant.
There are a lot of differences. And if you read the opinion, and this will be linked in the podcast notes, I really suggest it. The first 80 or so pages are very well written, and it gives a really good high school biology introduction to genetics and the processes in the body. And, I want to commend the judge on that for what's a very difficult topic. He did a very good job. But the problem is that it's a high school biology view of the differences between DNA in the body and purified DNA. And when you get down to it, there are substantial differences between the DNA that you're going to find in somebody's cell and the DNA that you're going to find in the lab, a synthesized molecule of DNA, or what's called the cDNA molecule. The DNA that's in the cell that's part of your genome is going to have a lot of secondary structure. It's going to have a lot of things like methyl groups that are added to it, a lot of proteins that are attached on it, and all of those proteins, all of those different groupings, little modifications that your body does to this DNA encode a lot of extra information about how it's expressed, when it's made. It can inhibit the production of the protein that the DNA encodes. It can promote it. It can make it, more. It can turn it off at certain stages during development or turn it on during certain stages in development. And the judge did not consider any of those, and I don't even know if they were before him, because you walk a really fine line when you're litigating a case like this. Where do you draw the line between trying to give the judge all of the information that he needs when at the same time not, overwhelming the judge with scientific information that he or she won't be able to understand in the amount of time that you have to explain it to him. It's a really tough line to draw, and I don't know if we don't have the record below in its entirety. I don't know how much of that information was given to the judge, and I don't know how much of it was, strategic decision not to give the information. So there are substantial differences between DNA in the cell and DNA in the, synthesized DNA in the lab that the judge really didn't address. And I don't know if that's because he wasn't given that information or because he just didn't think it was relevant. We're just about out of time on this story. Any last thoughts, Dominic?
All set here.
David?
Just one really quick one, and that's, this really strikes me as more of a legislative issue than it is an issue that should be decided by a judge. Everyone right now is predicting that this is probably going to eventually make its way to the Supreme Court. Myriad already came out and said that they're going to appeal the decision, which of course was a district court decision. So this is going to drag out for several years. But from the ethical standpoint, it strikes me that if people really feel strongly about this, this is something you should contact your local congressional representative and, get them to formulate some sort of, I don't know, legislative solution to this that isn't, that takes all of those private rights that might be associated with a patent and genetic material out of private hands and, allows at least some for some measure of universities to continue conducting research on genetic issues and especially like oncology or cancer.
I'll mention that, this was, like Dave said, it's a district court opinion. So this is going to be appealed to the Second Circuit, who just wrote a case that we're going to talk about in a second. And then from there, if either party gets an adverse decision against it, they would be able to appeal to, petition the Supreme Court to take the case. On paper, it's not a great case for the Supreme Court to take because this is the only court that's decided it. There isn't really a split between courts as to, oh no, it's a CAFC. It would be appealed to the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. Strike everything I just said. It's fine. The Supreme Court has a decent chance of taking this case, should it go that far. Okay, so I guess, did somebody want to chime in and say something?
Oh yeah, another quick thing too is that because these patents all involve methods and process claims, it will likely be subject to the Bilski opinion, which comes down in hopefully a couple of months too. So even though Bilski, like it deals with just a method of hedging commodities, just like that applies to software patents and the processes that might be related to software patents, it might as well apply to genetic and diagnostic testing patents like this.
Yeah, not all of these claims were process patents, but there will likely be some debate as to how Bilski applies to the process claims here, and I mean process claims everywhere. So moving on to our next case, this is another long brewing battle. This started when Tiffany, the company that makes silver jewelry coveted by women everywhere. And I guess probably some men too, although I can't claim to have ever wanted anything from Tiffany's. They sued eBay because apparently there is a large amount of counterfeit Tiffany product on eBay. Either something that's advertised as being Tiffany or something that's says similar to Tiffany's, whatever, or this is the same as Tiffany's, but it's not branded as Tiffany's. So Tiffany's filed suit, I believe, in district court somewhere in New York, probably Southern District or Eastern District of New York. I don't remember off the top of my head. But and in 2008, the district court there handed Tiffany, sorry, handed eBay a rather substantial victory in that case. Dominic, do you think you can just run down really quick bullet points of what the essence of that district court opinion was?
So basically, Tiffany was suing eBay because eBay had these listings of these counterfeit products on its website with, and it wasn't taking it down. Tiffany requested a couple times for eBay to take it down, and when they did request it, eBay would take it down rather promptly, but that wasn't enough for Tiffany. They wanted a little more. They wanted eBay to proactively look for Tiffany merchandise that was fake and to take it down. One thing that came out in the discovery for this case is that Tiffany only had one person on staff to deal with the whole trademark issue, and they sort of wanted eBay to carry everything in terms of policing eBay for Tiffany products.
One of the other things that Tiffany did in the district court is they tried to make an argument that anytime, they somebody put up five or more allegedly infringing products, that eBay, that should be a red flag, kind of like how in the DMCA area, if you have somebody who's a repeat infringer, there has to be some process in place to deal with them. What Tiffany was trying to do was say that, liability should attach to eBay for, supporting and allowing these counterfeit things to be up there once one person has posted five or more things that Tiffany has flagged as counterfeit. And part of the problem with that was that Tiffany's just pulled this number out of thin air. There is no precedent. There's nothing that says, once eBay has, five takedown notices about this allegedly infringing product, that they're suddenly liable for it. And I think one of Tiffany's big problems in this case was trying to support that. And they lost on that at the district court. And then the district court's opinion was affirmed almost entirely in the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. David, can you talk briefly about what the differences were? Where the federal, where the appeals court departed from the district court?
Maybe you should lead into that a little bit more specifically.
Okay, so the district court, after what the district court had, what's called a bench trial, which is where instead of having a jury, you just present evidence to the judge and you give your opening and closing statements to the judge. And then at the end, instead of a jury handing down a verdict, the judge will type up fairly extensive written opinion where he lists out what facts he found to be credible, which facts he didn't, and then goes through the law and applies the law and comes to a conclusion in that case. The judge, I believe, ruled for Tiffany on virtually everything in that case. On appeal, the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit reversed on false advertising. Is that enough of a lead-in, David? Can you talk a little bit about the false advertising aspect of this?
Basically, Tiffany's argument was that eBay falsely advertised legitimate Tiffany goods because it advert if you looked on their website, it said Tiffany good, and since it was under eBay's control, they were falsely advertising legitimate Tiffany goods, even though the goods were counterfeit.
Yeah, so the thing that the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit was saying there is that, yes, there were some legitimate goods, but eBay, at this point has knowledge that there are counterfeit goods on the site. And the question for false advertising is essentially whether or not it was likely to mislead or confuse customers, as opposed to the trademark question, which is whether there is a substantial likelihood of confusion. And the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit said, oh, we're going to remand on this one because there needs to be, I believe it was more fact that there had to be more factual findings as to whether or not eBay these ads were likely to mislead or confuse consumers. Does that sound right? I'm looking for what exactly they did with that.
That sounds right. The court said
Right.
an online advertiser such as eBay need not cease its advertisements for a kind of goods only because it knows that not all of these goods are authentic. A disclaimer might suffice, but the law prohibits an advertisement that implies all the goods offered on a defendant's websites are genuine when in fact a sizable portion of them are not.
Yeah, they say, quote, we are unable to affirm on the record before us the district court's further conclusion that eBay's advertisements were, quote, not likely to mislead or confuse consumers. So there's a little bit of a double negative there, but they couldn't affirm the ruling that these weren't likely to mislead consumers. There was some other interesting, I guess, dicta mostly that came out of this case, which was this willful blindness. David, you were mentioning, was it David or Dominic who was mentioning the willful blindness? Dominic, you were mentioning that. Can you talk a little bit about that willful blindness language and what that may mean?
Well, basically, it's kind of a odd standard because basically, suppose eBay becomes aware that there are counterfeit goods on counterfeit Tiffany goods on its website. The willful blindness standard basically says that if it has reason to suspect, not even just being aware, but if it has reason to suspect that users of eBay are infringing the Tiffany trademark, it can't willfully be blind by ignoring that or attempting to ignore that. It's a good question what that actually means, because in this particular case, Tiffany sent cease and desist letters to eBay. eBay even instituted extra filtering efforts for Tiffany, specifically to try to catch Tiffany counterfeits. So it's unclear what willful blindness will mean in practice, especially considering that the standard is the reason to suspect user infringement and the ignorance of that fact. It's not clear, at least from the court's opinion, what the reason to suspect might actually mean.
Yeah, it's also kind of a willful blindness thing is not something that you see crop up in civil litigation that often. You know, the first time I ever encountered this was in a criminal case where usually knowledge of something happening would have to be an element of the crime, and the person kind of willfully turned a blind eye to this thing. They knew it was happening, but they, you know, kind of plugged their ears and said la 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 la, so they wouldn't, you know, have actual knowledge of it. And in those cases, courts will sometimes, where there's sufficient proof of, you know, plugging your ears and saying la la la, the court will say, you know what, you can't do that. You can't have an inkling of what's happening and then turn away just to make sure that you don't, you know, criminal liability won't attach. But it's not, in my experience at least, a terribly common thing to crop up in a civil litigation, because usually you just know or you don't know. Any of you ever come across this in a civil case, Dominic?
No.
David?
Yeah, no, not me either. Definitely not in this context.
Okay. I'm just about out of things to say about this. Any last thoughts, David?
Yeah, I mean, I could chime in a little bit. I just can't help but note the corollary between the Tiffany arguments and some of the arguments that we see from, say, the content producing companies that are involved in the YouTube litigation, where they sort of want the service provider to do all of the policing to take items down. What strikes me as really unfair is, from Tiffany's vantage point of sitting behind a computer screen and looking at eBay listings, how is it that they can determine whether a particular listing on eBay is in fact a non-authentic Tiffany item? And they can't do that unless they're actually buying the items and inspecting them directly. So that it just follows that they can't be looking at all of the items that are listed on eBay that claim to be Tiffany jewelry and be able to establish that all or most of them are in fact counterfeit. There have to be some legitimate ones out there. And Tiffany doesn't really have the right to control these sort of secondary sales. I mean, who's to say that I can't go into Tiffany's, purchase some sort of jewelry for, say, my girlfriend or something like that, and then decide that, oh, actually, I want to resell them on eBay. And under that, like, there's nothing wrong with that under the law for me to go on and sell that. But what Tiffany is saying here is that there's a high likelihood of what I'm selling on eBay is non-authentic and it's a counterfeit item. And so I just don't really see Tiffany's issue with all of the sales on eBay, and I don't know that there's a good way for them to police that activity.
If some of these products aren't products that Tiffany currently manufactures or had manufactured in the past, it'd be fairly easy to look at something and immediately know that it was counterfeit Tiffany's. That's one way that I think you'd be able to do that. But, you know, I agree, for secondhand sales, unless there's some sort of warranty issue, you're not going to be able to really say that it's incorrect to brand it Tiffany's. And really quick, if you sell something on a gray market good, so let's say you buy a camera in, you know, Japan for less than it sells in America, and you bring it to America and you resell it in America, you'd think that you'd be able to brand it as, you know, say Sony. But if Sony offers that camera with a different warranty in America than it comes with in Japan, there have been some cases that say, hey, you can't really call it that, because, you know, when you say Sony, people are going to assume that it comes with that warranty because you're selling it in the U.S. But since it's a gray market good, it really doesn't. I know very little about Tiffany jewelry, but so I don't think it comes with any type of warranty. I guess if there aren't any other thoughts, we'll move on to the last.
From what I understand, they just want to basically control secondary market sales because they're worried that consumers will be taken in by counterfeits. Even if you do have a legitimate piece of Tiffany jewelry, they would rather you not resell it.
I guess the other problem is that they're going after the service provider here. They're not going after the individuals who are selling the items on eBay. Legal process does exist where they could go after those people who put up the listings themselves. My guess is it's just too onerous for Tiffany to do that because it would take a lot of time. And if you take the argument that there might be thousands, if not tens of thousands, of items on eBay which are potentially counterfeit Tiffany goods, that's a lot of cease and desist letters to send out. It would be a lot of follow-up in terms of subpoenas that would need to be issued in order to identify those individuals who might be hiding behind some sort of pseudonym or user handle that they have on eBay, and trying to identify them and getting them to stop selling them. So rather than do that, why don't we just sue eBay and see if we can get eBay to stop all of this nonsense right away.
Right. So I guess with a final admonition as to David to not talk about buying your girlfriend Tiffany's on a podcast that she listens to, lest you get any ideas, I think we'll move on to the last story, which is that a group of independent movie makers have kind of banded together, and they sold the rights to litigate. I guess the best way to put this is they sold the rights to litigate certain copyright infringement claims to a company called the U.S. Copyright Group. The U.S. Copyright Group then monitored downloads of these movies on BitTorrent and sent 20,000 demand letters to alleged file sharers. So before we talk about this in any more depth, I want to say that this is one of the most ingenious ways to monetize part of movie revenue that I think I've ever seen. And that these movie the people who have these movies, you know, the people who produce these and have the rights to them didn't say, you know, oh, we'll go out RIAA style and, you know, sue the people. Sue the people or send demand letters to these people individually. No. They monetized it by selling the rights to somebody else to go after these people and litigate it, which, I mean, I don't approve of, but I think it's kind of clever. Any thoughts on that before we dive into, you know, what's actually going on here?
It is kind of clever, honestly. I mean, they get all the money of suing people with none of the bad publicity of having to do it themselves. If people don't pay attention to this story and learn that they just contracted people to sue people for them, or threaten suit, really.
If you're an individual who has been downloading a lot of film or television online and you receive one of these demand letters that lists, let's say, I don't know, 50 different instances of files that you've downloaded that are infringing, and let's just say that that individual's, you know, a poor college student or something, not necessarily financially poor, I guess. If you receive a demand letter that says, well, you can settle for $2,000 or we'll sue you, you know, some of those kids or whoever they might be more interested in just settling it out for the $2,000 rather than facing a scary court.
Yeah, and I think the vast majority of the RIAA cases that actually went to litigation shows that settling is, in fact, the much better idea unless you actually did not share the files on the internet. Because, you know, everyone that's gone to, both of the ones that have gone to trial, the people have ended up admitting on the stand that they did, in fact, share the files and that they previously lied about it. So usually not worth it to go to trial if you did, in fact, infringe the copyrights. I guess my first question is, you know, they say that they've sent out 20,000 demand letters and they're going to send about another 30,000 demand letters. That's a lot of people to be going with. Oh, and I want to clear one thing up. Some of the stories that reported this said that, you know, they've filed 20,000 lawsuits. They have not filed 20,000 lawsuits, and they are not intending to file 30,000 more lawsuits. What they've done is send letters out to people saying, listen, we're pretty sure you did this. Call us and we'll talk on the phone about you paying us lots of money. Filing 20,000 lawsuits would be incredibly expensive, and they would not recoup all of that money. There are filing fees, and there are, you know, fees associated with actually setting up these complaints and you know, making sure that, you know, they're all good. So again, no. As far as I at least understand, no lawsuits have actually been filed. Just demand letters have been sent saying, call us up and give us money and we'll drop this lawsuit. David, do you have any particular thoughts on this?
No, just sort of an interesting comment. I mean, for years I listened to people that I knew talk about how downloading television and film is entirely different because the MPAA isn't really going after anybody. It's all the pursued of the crusade of the RIAA who's going after all of the file sharers online. But now we find that's not really the case, and after all, someone was monitoring this and looking for a way to monetize it, so it's a little bit unfortunate. As far as I can tell, the MPAA is entirely within its right to sell these litigation rights to a third party to go after people, so I don't know that you're going to see a whole lot of backlash in terms of legal action against the MPAA for doing this, but it looks like that this might be a successful way to go about this, at least financially successful. I don't know that in the end that this is going to have any ultimate effect on the amount of people out there who are participating in file sharing, though.
For the record, I don't think the MPAA is involved in this yet. My impression was that it was only independent filmmakers who were involved, and that the MPAA, you know, kind of endorsed this and said, you know, we're interested to see where this goes, but we're not on board quite yet.
Ah, well, there you go.
It was a tacit. It wasn't really so much an endorsement, so much as a tacit sort of. Go ahead, let's see how you guys do.
Yeah, they looking at an article right now. They're saying that they want to see proof that the ISPs would be cooperative, which I mean is fair. Some of the ISPs in this case were very cooperative. The RIAA litigation was very cooperative, and some of them, you know, said we're not going to hand this over unless you give us a subpoena, and subpoenas cost money, and you know, the more money you spend on each individual infringer, the less likely alleged infringer, the less likely you are going to be able to recover any money in these cases, or enough money to cover your costs or to make this worthwhile.
It looks like they're charging about $32 to $60 for each IP address that they request, but that's just for one or two ISPs, I think. So that's a lot of money if you consider 20,000 demand letters.
Yeah, but on the flip side, if you can get most of them to settle for $2,000, or, you know, doing some quick math, if you can get 30 to settle for... No, if you get one to settle for $2,000, you would cover the cost of getting 30 IP addresses. You know, it'd be $1,800. So, I mean, you don't have to have great demand letter to return value to at least cover your costs here. I mean, I don't know if they actually expect to turn a huge profit, but, you know, getting one settlement out of 30 demand letters, I don't think is unreasonable. Although I don't have any numbers as how well the RIAA did with their demand letters. Either of you guys ever seen numbers about that?
No, I don't. But over the years, the RIAA used to say that it was an effective way to go about doing things. But I think a year or two after that whole campaign, people have suggested that it really didn't do that much for them overall. I mean, when you consider the cost of going to... Well, I guess there's only really two trials, but you have to assume that there was a bunch of other litigation and associated costs with suits that were filed in court. But, I mean, we know the two biggest examples, right? The Tenenbaum case and the Thomas Rasset case. The attorney's fees in those cases were probably somewhere along the line of $200,000 to $500,000. I've seen those figures.
And keep in mind that the Rasset case has had two trials so far and is going to have a third, and we don't know what's going to happen with the Tenenbaum case. Well, the third trial is just going to be on damages for the Rasset case, but there are two full trials up until this point. So, you know, while there have only been two cases that have gone to trial, there are going to be four total trials, at least up until this point. I'm kind of out of things to talk about this. Dominic, do you have anything else to add?
It'll be interesting to see whether they succeed with this.
Yeah, and what other areas can monetize this? If the RIAA tried and failed and is, you know, no longer pursuing this, you know, what other industries could try to do this? You know, maybe we'll see the game industry suing gamers next. David, any last thoughts?
I'm a little surprised that this involves independent film and TV makers. I usually think of those guys as being a little bit more soft to online infringement, but I don't know. This is what happens, I guess, and maybe the MPAA isn't far behind.
Yeah, I think they may be less concerned about it. But the flip side of that is they want to fund their next project, and the more money that they can go to investors and say, we'll get, distribution, we'll get, money from the distribution rights for, these major countries that we plan to do it on. We'll get money from the DVD rights, we'll get money from the online streaming rights and the on-demand, cable rights, and then we'll get money for being able to sell the rights to litigate illegal file sharing. And my guess is they're concerned with the bottom line as much as the next guy. And the plus side about this is that they've got much more of a shield when it comes to PR than the RIAA did, where people got very angry at the Recording Industry Association of America and the individual artists. A lot of them were saying, "Listen, this isn't us. We have nothing to do with this. If we could stop it, we don't want our fans getting sued." And this U.S. copyright group, this hereto unheard of organization that's filing these demand letters, they're for at least for now taking all the brunt of the hatred, which from a PR standpoint is great for the independent filmmakers. So I guess if nobody else has anything to say, I'd like to thank you all for listening to this, the 44th episode of the Technically Legal Podcast. If you want to hear more about Technically Legal, you can head over to our website, www.technicallylegal.org, or follow us on Twitter. That's @TechLegal. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at podcast@technicallylegal.org. So signing off, I'm Ben Snakeoff.
I'm Dominic Ravier.
And I'm David O'Brien.
Thanks for listening.